We are going to dive into the book of Daniel, chapter 1 today. We actually are going to look at the first 7 chapters in 5 weeks together. So we aren't going to be able to finish the full book, but there are going to be some online resources if you want to keep going. But we are going to look at the first 6 chapters, which are mainly around narrative. And then from then onwards, the book transitions into being about the predicted future, kind of visions of what the future would look like. And so it's a book we believe is timely and one that we're very excited about. And as Steph said, we'll then round out the year with the rest of the book of Ephesians. Just to locate you in the book of Daniel, you see there we've got a tagline, following God in a godless world. What we're talking about here are, in a way, the tale of two cities. Jerusalem, we're going to see today, is about to get sacked. The physical city you can find on a map is about to get ransacked by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And a whole group of people are getting taken across to the second city, which is part of the picture, which is Babylon. But you'll notice that it's actually not just geography places on a map. What actually this is about is about another city, which is often referred to as the heavenly city or the new Jerusalem. It's about the fact that every single person in this life, created in the image of God, finds themselves living in a city, Babylon or Cape Town, but longing for a city like the new Jerusalem. Jesus would get his disciples to pray and say, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Saying this kingdom, this new city, this Zion, this other city is what we long for, even though we find ourselves in this city. And so we are going to learn from Daniel, the one who gets taken from the physical city of Jerusalem to Babylon, what it means to live in a city like this, but longing for the better city that is yet to come. There are many parallels to the city of Cape Town today. Daniel, we're going to see, is going to go through political upheaval, spiritual upheaval, personal upheaval, and I think we can learn a lot from the way he lived his life. So if you're visiting today, I'm so excited that you've joined us on that one of this particular journey, and perhaps you'll start to see already the difference that following God could make in this city. So the title for tonight is going to be Following God into Exile. That's the big event that happens, is exile. And so the 3 parts we're going to do is we're going to read slowly through the book of Daniel chapter 1. We're going to stop at various points as we go along. The first point is going to be about into exile. What does that actually mean? The second is then to focus in on what following God would look like. And then finally, you'll notice I'm going to put a little question mark at the end because, well, how does that work out? What does it look like to follow God into exile? So let's read from chapter 1, verse 1, and we'll get stuck into Daniel together. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, a little rebranding exercise here. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. So there we go. We stop there. What we're seeing here is a group of people getting taken into exile. If we go back to verse number 1, you'll see that Jerusalem is under siege. The city of God, the people of God, are under siege. And what's quite interesting is you might think, but these are the good guys. Why are they getting besieged by Nebuchadnezzar? The truth is that they had been set aside by God, but they'd for a long time been living without God foremost in their lives. You see, if you go back to the story of God, you've got God creating, but you've got to see a group of people very quickly going, you know what, I want to make a name for myself. I don't think I need a God. I don't think there is a God. And they make it on their own. Adam and Eve right at the beginning. And it got progressively worse right into Genesis 11, if you look right at the beginning of the Bible, where a group of people get together and they say, you know what, we don't need God. We're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to build up to the heavens. And so the Tower of Babel goes up before confusion spreads them out across the world. Well, guess where the Tower of Babel was made? We can't quite see it in this version because the word used at the bottom there is Babylonia, but the real word is Shinar, which speaks of the exact place in Genesis 11 where the Tower of Babel was built. Now, into that confusion, what God did right at the beginning is he said, I know you guys are trying to do life without me, but I love you so much that I'm not going to let you live in that self-denial and self-deception. And so I'm going to pick one of you, Abraham. I'm going to pick him, not because there's anything special about him, but I'm going to bless him to be a blessing. I'm going to, through him, show the world what God would be like if he was in charge. I'm going to bless you to be a blessing. And so the people of God go throughout history, captive in Egypt, released from Egypt, and they find themselves with a God who's like no other, who says he will be with them, he'll be present with them. He will be the living God. And what we see here is that whole promised chosen people of God being besieged. And we see that success is the result, that the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. That this group of people who denied God with their actions were suddenly handed over to the life they had wanted, a life of independence, a life of rebellion towards God, with all the consequences that came tumbling out. Think about the political situation here. They've lost their king. They've lost their land. They've lost any parliament. Any kind of leadership that they had is gone. Any kind of authority they've had. This is political upheaval on another level. And they're taken all the way back to where the Tower of Babel went up, all the way back to Shinar, all the way back to the place where rebellion had broken out on such an epic scale. They had allowed their hearts to drift so far that God essentially left them to their own desires, and the consequences are playing out. Huge political upheaval. But it's not just politics, it's also spiritual. Do you notice what else happens here? That the temple of God, which we will find out gets destroyed in a little while, first just gets ransacked with all the articles that were on display, taken back, and how's this, to the temple of his God in Babylonia. Dragged all the way 500 kilometers from Jerusalem back to the temples of Babylon. The confiscation of these items and their deposit in a Babylonian temple was a dramatic declaration by Nebuchadnezzar saying, my God is better than your God. And what's so unique about this temple was that it never had any image. It was, as far as historians are concerned, the only temple around that time that didn't have any image. Because remember, this was a living God who said, I will be with my people. I will presence myself with them. And so there was no images to be destroyed or nothing to be dragged back of that sort. But people that had always looked at this rather funny God with no image must have thought, okay, well, that was weird and it's failed clearly because it's over. The temple has been ransacked. The kingdom has gone. Whatever that was, it's been politically turned upside down and spiritually it's bankrupt. It has no power. We've got no temple, no priesthood, no items even in the temple. Exile is not looking too good for the people of God. But into all of this, even more than just the political and the kind of spiritual, these large kind of developments, there's the personal story about a probably around 15-year-old boy, Daniel, and his mates who get kidnapped. You get taken 500 kilometers away. We don't know enough about their family to piece it all together, but obviously they met the criteria that we've listed there from verse 3. The young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude, you'll see that they are effectively put into the king's service. So the enemy that's just defeated them, they're now told, come and enroll. They're told that they have got to learn the language and the literature of Babylon, and they're told effectively that it's 3 years. This is Hogwarts on the Babylonian scale. They have to learn literature, they've got to learn language, and they've got to learn a whole new lifestyle. This would have been tough for anyone. And it gets even worse if you look at some of the language there. Aspenaz is described as the chief of court officials. A more specific translation would be the chief eunuch. And if you think about it, who is the chief of eunuchs in charge of? The eunuchs, right? And so work out the degree to which this particular exile had been devastating for Daniel. There's no mention of any future kids, any marriage, and more than likely, though it cannot be proved specifically, he was castrated as part of this process of bringing him into Babylonian court. His lifestyle was also threatened in the sense that the king made his table available. It wasn't just language and literature, it was the king's table, a whole new lifestyle, all part of the soft diplomacy of Babylon. They didn't want these people brought back to Babylon to cause trouble. They wanted them to basically go, hey, this is not such a bad place. The king's table is bountiful. There's much for me to enjoy here. There's lots of life to be lived. And in fact, Jerusalem was a bit of a backwater compared to this happening in place. Babylon's empire was rolling through history, building up more and more conquered people and gathering them into this place of festivities. And the tale of two cities, this place, Babylon, was just getting bigger and bigger, more and more cosmopolitan. It was getting more and more exciting. In fact, becomes an adjective for the rest of Scripture. When things get really bad, the kind of phrase is, it gets Babylon bad. It's kind of a way of speaking about all the things that went on in Babylon. And this city is on the up. This city is flourishing. And Nebuchadnezzar knows it, and he kind of has one final swing at, yeah, he sorted out the politics, he sorted out this temple with no God. Now he wants to sort out Daniel and his mates, and he actually gives them new names. And in the next slide, you'll see just how these names were so against the grain of how they had raised themselves. See, Daniel, his parents had lovingly looked at him, and they had called him, God is my judge. Just think of little Stella tonight, kind of getting named by her parents. Daniel would have been called, God is my judge. And while Nebuchadnezzar said, no, you're going to be known as Bel's prince from now on. Bel being one of his many gods that he had in Babylon. How about Hananiah, which means beloved by the Lord. This is Yahweh. This is the God of no image. And he was renamed Shadrach, meaning illuminated by sun god. Mishael, who is as God, was renamed who is like Venus. And then finally, Azariah, the Lord is my help, was renamed servant of Nego. In each of these, the identities get shifted. Their names get shifted. Imagine your whole life being named one thing and getting renamed. Have you ever done a half marathon on someone else's ticket? I know you're not supposed to. But often they print the name, the Two Oceans name. And for the whole run, people are going, hey, Jennifer. And you're like, hey. Like, that's me. I remember it's me. It's kind of a disconcerting thing. It is just a weird experience. I didn't call myself Jennifer in case you're worried. But the bottom line is, suddenly, how do you feel about following God into exile when exile means this? Political wipeout, spiritual seeming wipeout, personal wipeout. That's what we're talking about when we talk about exile. We're not talking about some kind of Christian adventure book. It's like, woohoo, fire, lion's den, you know, Daniel. The fact that these guys make it through is actually the exception that proves that they are the exception. There are many God-fearing, God-following people that never made it through the fires, that never made it through the persecution, that never made it through the hard times. But these people that did are going to help us answer the big questions we might have, which is, what happens when there's just chaos? What happens when it feels like there is no God? What happens when it feels like God is just incidental or maybe not even existent? Those deeper questions that lie underneath all of us. Is God even alive? Is God even real? And there are many parallels for us in the city of Cape Town. I mean, at a superficial level, there's a lot of political uncertainty at the moment, economic inequality that causes the haves and the have-nots. The king's table is laid out for some, but not for others. There's personal hardship that is amongst us, and it varies greatly. There's some of us that lose it because we you know, our Word document got wiped out without saving, you know, and it's the end of the world. But for other of us, there's a lot more going on in our lives that leaves us feeling the effects of being tossed to and fro. And we looked at last week in the book of Ephesians about the danger of being tossed to and fro by winds and waves and not knowing which way is up. It's so much so that we could question the existence of God. And I thought right now at the beginning, we should probably just make one point, which is that even though you might feel Cape Town is a place of exile for you, I want to make this point, one application right up front, which is that you're not in Cape Town by accident. You're not in Cape Town by accident. Right there in the earliest verses, it would have said, the Lord delivered. Did you guys see it there? It said, the Lord delivered. It meant that even behind all this chaos, God was in control still, and he was at work with his people. And so, Christ follower, tonight, I'm telling you that being in exile is normal. Being in a city that doesn't match up to the New Jerusalem is normal. That gap is normal. Don't wait for perfect conditions or a perfect church before getting stuck in. This environment of upheaval is what God has placed us in. And I thought, just to help us locate ourselves, that perhaps I'd just describe quickly how Cape Town can be sometimes overwhelming. What are some of the winds and waves that can toss us to and fro? And I know you would have looked at a few last week, but I just thought it would be helpful that although we don't have a Nebuchadnezzar who's kind of using hard diplomacy and soft diplomacy to shake us up and down, we do have powerful thoughts and ideas that are gripping our hearts. And I thought I'd fly through a quick list of those. The first one is postmodernism. Postmodernism is something that came out of the 60s, a kind of reaction to the excesses of modernism, and it's kind of come through as the dominant philosophical framework. Simply said, it's a suspicion of any meta-narrative, any big story. Anyone who claims, hey, I've got the story, or I've got truth, we're straight away suspicious and saying, who do you think you are to have the story? Who are you to tell us how to believe? And of course, that means that there's a lot of suspicion on any belief systems and certainly any institution that would stand for and would present a story into which we could live. The second one, which is gripping us, is moral therapeutic deism. This framework was coined by sociologist Christian Smith in 2005. And effectively, it says that most people around today go, yeah, there's a God, he's here, but he largely just leaves me alone unless I need help. Then that God, we kind of get involved and would try and prop me up. But he's generally otherwise going to leave me alone. And so there's a sense of morals, but really a God's here to prop me up more than I am here to learn about that God. Thirdly, how about this? The age of disenchantment. Charles Taylor in The Secular Age, a book everyone quotes but no one reads, says that there was a belief in transcendence in the old days. What do I mean by that? Angels, demons, spirits, superstitions. But that's very much not the thing anymore. We now believe in the immanent world, the world we can feel and touch, the materialist world. And what's interesting is that we believe, therefore, we can ignore all this stuff, focus in on what is here, tangible, and we can form what he calls buffered selves, lives that decide what we allow into our filters and not. And we can kind of control the world by protecting ourselves from anything we don't understand. What's so fascinating about this is that the trend was meant to be away from any superstition, but any parent to go shopping, it's unicorns and rainbows. Literally, everything you want to buy is full of unicorns, full of angels, Twilight series about vampires. Which boy will she choose? It just explodes in a world which is supposed to be becoming more and more disenchanted. It seems like we're more and more fascinated with things which aren't easy to grasp materially. How about this, the age of authenticity? This is basically the age in which we live in, where individual construction and actualization of the self is the highest individual good. You do you. Become your best self. Nobody has the authority to tell you otherwise. And nothing that historically would have shaped you should be taken into account. Your family, geography, religion, or social demographic means nothing. You do you, and you decide what would be best for you. How about this, private faith versus the public square? Faith in our modern picture is accepted largely as a private affair. You do you in private with whatever faith or God you want. The public square, however, is seen as neutral territory. Anyone who presents an argument based on faith, based on creation, based on an understanding of who humans are, anyone who does that is violating the kind of principles we've established. That stuff stays in private. And then finally, globalization and pluralism says that, hey, we're global neighbors. We know more about each other than ever before. And with all these other faith systems we've been introduced to, is it really plausible or even credible for Christianity or any other faith system to say that they have the truth? Aren't all roads leading to the same God after all? And so if I put that whole list up, you might find yourself bobbing around in Cape Town with the winds and waves of these thoughts taking over you to a place where you'd say, man, Daniel finds himself disorientated and I also find myself disorientated. We want to take some time to unpack these and understand these so we can better understand our hearts. But just because Nebuchadnezzar isn't roaming around doesn't mean we also aren't being tempted to lose sight of who God is. An encouragement to each and every one of us. We're not put into Cape Town by accident. God has got us here, and we don't need a Christian context to lead Christian lives. Christianity doesn't require a 50% majority plus one. We see in Scripture over and over these examples of Joseph in Egypt, Daniel and Esther now in Babylon, Nehemiah in the time of the Persians, the early church in the Roman Empire, and right now Christ follows in the Middle East and China, flourishing as they follow God, even though the context doesn't look anything like the New Jerusalem. So let's get stuck in. God's got us here for a reason. And let's follow God into this city. Follow God into exile. So let's see what Daniel does. He's had his world upside down. He's now at Hogwarts for the next 3 years. And he needs to follow the new literature, language, and lifestyle. What does he do? Where does he draw the line? What is he going to do as he follows God into exile? Let's have a look from verse 8. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. Daniel then said to the God, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. So we'll find out what happens. That's our last point for tonight. But what effectively has happened here, verse 8, is but Daniel resolved. You see it there, the words, that Daniel has come and resolved. He's drawn a line. He said, I'm not going to give in to this lifestyle, which is quite interesting, right? Because he said yes to 3 years of studying literature and language. He said yes to his name being changed, having a whole rebranding exercise, essentially being told he has a whole new identity for you. He said yes to that. But he draws a line here. Why there? Why with this lifestyle? Why with this food? Why is that where he decides to make his stand? Something which we're grappling with. If you're in the city and you're getting influenced by all kinds of things, how do you resolve? What does following God look like? What does following God look like? Well, one thing which is clear in the law, which Daniel would have read and understood, was that God had given his people particular diet laws. He'd said, guys, I'm going to make you distinct. The meal and your hospitality, the way you do life is important. Now I'm going to give you some guidance on how to do that. And so he knew quite clearly that obedience to God would mean that he should not compromise in his diet. It's clearly represented in God's word. And so he takes that next step of obedience. He starts with what's right in front of him. He might not have the full picture of all this other chaotic stuff happening, but he can see clearly this is something God has clearly spoken on. I'm going to choose God's way ahead of Nebuchadnezzar's way. Of course, huge risk involved, yeah? How's Nebuchadnezzar, I've dragged you 500 kilometers, I brought you all the way, and you're not taking drink. I mean, this could be the end of him, but he's saying, hey, it's quite clear to me, this is what God's called me to, and so I'm going to be obedient. And if we dig a little bit deeper, do you think that maybe Daniel said, you know what, you can call me all this new name, you can, because I know what my real name is. I know my true identity. I've settled that. I know who I am. God will be my judge. And so you can call me whatever you want. I can't take responsibility for what you call me, but I'm secure in who I am. And yes, you can teach me new language and new literature and tell me all the new stories of how the God of the Babylonians created the world and how the God of the Babylonians is fickle and how that God does life, multitudes of them. And I'll learn about that. I'm interested in that so I can better understand your world. But I know the God and his story, what Yahweh has done with his people. And so I'm secure learning about other things because I know the story that anchors my life. You see, he's not being tossed to and fro by the waves and the winds. He's anchored to the rock. While others sat down and just kind of complied, Daniel stood up. While others dissolved, Daniel resolved. And you can get a tattoo. And so his action here of drawing a line on the lifestyle was consistent with what God had taught his people. And so he probably said, you know what, this is confusing, I'm young, but man, this is clear. All this other stuff is confusing, but this is clear. God's taught us that this is what we should partake in, the kosher meals. And notice his heart behind this is not to kind of be a troublemaker, like make a stand. No, he's just been obedient. He's saying, God, this is what God's laid down, and I'm going to follow him. And you see, what God's laid down is for the good of his people. It's to bless them. It's not arbitrary. It's to bless them. And so he, in many ways, is blessing the people that have captured him because he's saying, hey, there's a better way to do this. There's a better way of raising us. There's a better way in which we can be healthy. There's something of God's wisdom in these dietary laws. And he's going to be a blessing. He's not just kind of being obstinate. He's actually going to be a blessing to them. And this is exactly what Jeremiah, Ezekiel, these other prophets that were prophesying at the time of their exile, this is what they said should be the heart attitude of people that follow God into exile. It shouldn't be to just be distinct for the sake of being distinct. No, it's to bless those that you're a part of. And this is what Jeremiah in chapter 29 said. We looked at this last year as a community. I hope some of it still resonates with you. He said, this is what the Lord Almighty, Jeremiah 29 verses 4 to 7. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, settle down, plant gardens, eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters to marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Get what an utterly unique attitude this is. I mean, you'd think the right approach would be, guys, keep separate, just wait for our time, we'll counter-strike and get out and get back to Jerusalem. Go into some kind of bomb shelter. Well, maybe just blend in, be a mirror, just whatever values they have reflected back. Just don't cause a fuss, just blend in. Maybe the approach was not a bomb shelter or a mirror, maybe it's just the parasite. Just go in there and just live the good life. Get everything you can from the city and then bail when it's convenient. But Jeremiah's articulate, and what Daniel lived out was this promise that if we bless the city, we likewise will be blessed and prosper. I love what Nicky Gumbel had to say once. He said, strong people stand up for themselves, but stronger people stand up for others. What God's saying is, hey, you can stand up for others. You can represent me before others and encourage them. So my second application is you're not in Cape Town by accident. The second one is that you should follow God, like Daniel did, in the city you called. Follow God in Cape Town. Do you see that verse? Daniel said he resolved not to defile himself. He looked at what God said and said, I'm going to go with God on this. Part of what maturing as a Christian is to agree with God more and more, faster and faster. Just come into agreement. Those obvious things in your life which are holding you back now are those things which you can start taking steps in. You might not see the full picture, but take the steps that you can see clearly. Daniel knew God, knew his truth, and he lived in obedience. And again, whilst I described the winds and the waves that kind of can come at a big level, what about those things that happen in our hearts that can be challenges for ourselves? That if I say, resolve, you go, but there's just some stuff in me that makes it hard for me to resolve, or that makes it hard for me to take a stand. Here are some things that I can identify with, maybe you can as well, to keep us stuck or paralyzed or afraid. There are things which perhaps have led to compromise or wounding or immaturity in our lives. So just a few categories, again, to fly through. First is sin and broken habits. The reality of our rebellion against God, our independence declaration, can lead to addiction, broken habits, especially if we keep hiding them. These can rob us of any courage or strength that we might have to lead or to take a stand. Because we're plagued with guilt, shame. There's an unwillingness to lead because we want to avoid being hypocritical, right? Especially because any stand that we take would put the spotlight on our lives. The other thing which can hold us back is functional idols. These are things which we love more than God. They're not just idols we put up. They're functional. In other words, they really do dictate the decisions we make, where our heart flows. They're good things that we've turned into ultimate things. And it takes much work to identify them, to name them and deconstruct them in our hearts to help us to then pursue God fully. How about this one? Fear of man. Fear of man. We just have an overactive self-consciousness. There's a reference group. There's a people, and they'll be different for all of us, but there's a group of people we think are cool. We want to be in there with them. We'd never say this out loud, of course. But what we long to do is understand what makes them tick. We don't ever want to be misunderstood by them, rejected by them, or be perceived as weird by them, because we'd lose access to something we perceive to be very valuable, which is acceptance by them. How about wounds? We all get hurt. No matter how much we desire to participate in the mission of God, wounds will keep us from effectiveness. It's a bit like having a broken leg and still trying to charge into battle and try and take a stand. And the good news is that in Christ, we have a wounded healer, one who can identify with all the pain we feel, and he can heal us. He doesn't just diagnose our wounds, but he can prescribe medicine and heal us to help us to be fully empowered. I'm resonating with a lot on these lists, and here's a big one, selfishness. It's hard to follow God in Cape Town because, man, my heart is occupied primarily with its own advancement, its own interest or comfort. It's not moved by compassion for other people, and mainly my focus is on maintaining my control over my time, my energy, my resources, and my commitments. David Foster Wallace, in a quite a famous YouTube video, you can watch it, I'm sure you wrote it first, it was called This Is Water, just describes some of our cultural moment we find ourselves in and how hard it is to identify. It gives the example of a fish that is so used to water, when someone asks them the question, what's water like? The fish just goes, what's water? And in many ways, we can just go through life unaware of our selfishness. Let's have a look at a quote that he gives. He says, here is just one example of the total wrongness of something I tend to be automatically sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I'm the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence. We rarely think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive, but it's pretty much the same for all of us. It is our default setting, hardwired into our circuit boards at birth. We think we're the center of the universe because pretty much 100% of we've ever experienced, we've been at the center of. But that can mean that we don't live lives focused on God. We focus on ourselves. The final one, guys, is triviality. The time and energy wasted by meaningless preoccupations of our attention. There's a new profession that's sprung up called attention engineers, which are designed to keep our attention, lock us in for long times. Hooked up to our smartphones, endless streaming entertainment, and we need to have a hot take on everything that's happening. It's never been easier to be pulled into the trivial. And so following God into exile comes with a whole bunch of challenges outside, but then when we look inside, a whole bunch of challenges in. How do we respond? Well, get a Daniel devotional would be one small step. Read the scripture, understand what he did in his context. And then secondly, Don't just think of being uber strategic. Sometimes we need to be uber dependent. We need to get together and pray. And that's what we're going to be doing on Thursday evenings as a community. Getting together on last Thursdays and saying, man, God, we need you if we are going to follow effectively. We need you to deal with our hearts and we need you to help us love the city of Cape Town. Can I release some of you that following God in Cape Town means that we're not called to save the world? We're only called to serve the world. I'll say that again. Following God in Cape Town means that we're not called to save the world, only serve the world. Saving the world is Jesus' role, and he's occupied that role. The job is taken. We aren't to have a Messiah complex. We're only to play a small part and to steward our time and place. We must learn to ask, what is the Father doing in this city, and understand our own callings and giftings, show up faithfully, and see God already at work in our city. So the question mark now comes. We're following God into exile. Daniel has done that. How did it work out? Let's have a look from verse 15. At the end of 10 days, they looked healthier. Some translations say fatter, which I can see why they changed. And better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the God took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, so they've graduated after 3 years, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. What we see as this beautiful story. Of course, Daniel writing it means that they were able to move all that way from Jerusalem to Babylon and thrive. God has answered his doubters. The empty temple, the political upheaval, the personal hardship. Looking back on his life, Daniel can write and speak about a God who delivered them from affliction. God is in control, even when things are totally crazy, going wild, even when things are going good, and they're able to interpret dreams, and they're able to understand, God is in control. There's supernatural events taking place in a secular city. In a city that had lost its way, God is still breaking in, and may it be the same in the city of Cape Town. God is turning up in the public sphere, right in the courts of authority, right where the king is, and he's changing culture. So as we come into land, a quick reminder of the applications before I make my third point. You're not in Cape Town by accident, remember? We saw that last little verse, verse 21, Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. That's a little spoiler alert, because that means that he stayed in Babylon for over 70 years. That's him writing at the end of his life saying, you know what, Nebuchadnezzar came and he went, and the Medo-Persians took over, and there's a new king in town, Cyrus, and I'm still around. Cyrus is going to throw me in a lion's den, spoiler alert, but I'm still around. And so if you're sitting in the city of Cape Town, you're saying, yeah, Paul, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. They were there for 70 years. He saw God work mightily through him. Remember to follow God in Cape Town. Daniel resolved not to defile himself. We've got stuff happening in our hearts, but let's also resolve that even when times get tough, we're going to move in the opposite spirit. We're going to deny the lifestyle maybe that Cape Town offers to us, and we're going to follow God's truth or what he wants for our sexuality, for our generosity, for the way that we live our lives. We're going to do it in community for his glory. The final point for tonight is just the reminder that God is in control even when everything seems out of control. God is in control even when everything seems out of control. Did you pick this up? Did you see all the times that the verses appeared? It's the same word translated slightly differently, but it speaks about a God who delivered them into exile, a God who caused the official to show favor and compassion, to even allow them to take the vegetable diet. And then again, the same God who gave them knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature. Even when it feels like everything is going crazy, God is in control. How do you feel about a God who, in the good times and the bad times, is still in control? Do you find yourself often saying, man, I don't think God would be like that. I don't think God would like that. My challenge to you would be to maybe say that you might have invented a God who looks a lot like you rather than accepted the God who's revealed himself to us in Jesus Christ. God is too kind to leave us in that state of self-deception, in that state of believing that's just us in this world, and he moves towards us in his loving kindness. And so in conclusion, I'd say to you that this God has a message for us to say that we need to rely on God's grace, not our goodness. That even when we're in exile, and even when we're trying to follow God, We rely on His grace, not our goodness. Abraham was full of fault. Moses was a murderer and a weak leader. David was an adulterer. Paul, a persecutor of the church. Peter, an overambitious zealot. In Daniel, we have a fine example, yes. But even then, we mustn't trust in him. We trust in God and His grace. We take eyes off of ourselves, and we look to the God who's in control, who can shape our desires and our confidence and our abilities. And I love that that word is translated gave right at the end, because isn't that reminding us of a God who continues to give, of a God who would give his one and only son. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him will have life. And what I'd love to do now is invite us to stand. The band's going to come, and we're going to have an opportunity to enjoy the communion meal. And I thought I'd just translate this meal and compare it to the meal that Nebuchadnezzar offered. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar said, hey, there's another life you can live here. You can live the Babylonian life. Here is a feast laid on for you. It looks fantastic. It has zero cost. But of course, we know there are all kinds of strings attached. He's capturing your heart and he's drawing you away from your Creator. Contrast that with the meal that Jesus Christ reminded his disciples to eat often. That was a meal that wasn't free. It was free, but it was costly. It was free to you and me, but it was costly. It cost him his life, and he laid it down. It didn't look nearly as lavish as Nebuchadnezzar's fare, but in it was life and life to the full. Perhaps for the first time tonight, do you want to come to the communion table and enjoy that meal, understanding that it's God's grace that draws us home, that brings exiles home, that New Jerusalem you've been longing for your whole life is just an echo of eternity that God's placed in your heart, and he's made reconciliation possible through his son, Jesus Christ. Sinners like you and me can come home and enjoy this meal prepared for us. We need the compassion of Jesus if we move out into the city. We need the compassion of Jesus to love like Daniel did, to pour out our lives. And so, Christ followers, as we come to the table, let's ask that Christ would once again stir our hearts to not have our eyes on ourselves, but on him and the great city he's called us to. Come and collect the communion meal, and I'd encourage you to pray in groups of two or three. Let's remind ourselves of the great feast that God has prepared for us to enjoy. Now let's do that together.